Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm talking with Pastor Jeremy Jernigan. He serves as an executive pastor at Central Christian Church in the Phoenix, Arizona area. And today I want to talk with him about his latest book called Redeeming Pleasure, How the Pursuit of Pleasure Mirrors Our Hunger for God. Jeremy, welcome to Life Quest.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why did you write this book at this time?
Well, I've actually had this conversation going since I was in high school. I remember watching people make this false choice between either God or pleasure. And so a lot of times what they do is they choose God, and they give up all pleasure, and so these become the very boring, legalistic Christians that sometimes we interact with. And then there's other people that pursue pleasure, but they think I have to give up God in the process, and so we get the idea of a guilty pleasure or, you know, a life of sin, if you will. And instead, I really think that what we're searching for when we search for pleasure is something that will complete us, and I think biblically what we see in the biblical narrative is that it's God himself that we're looking for. And so even if we go, you know, we search it in different areas, what we're really looking for is God himself. And so in the book, trying to show people of, hey, you don't need to make this choice. They're actually the same journey together.
I was surprised at the beginning of the book, or near the beginning, you actually quoted John Calvin on pleasure and food and what can get a delight out of that. This isn't always the picture some of us have of John Calvin.
Well, yeah, I also talk about John Piper and you
right.
know, both those guys, theologically, I don't always line up with. But what's interesting about this subject is, you know, I quote Epicurus throughout the book, who's an ancient, you know, Greek philosopher.
Right.
There's so many people who have wrestled with this topic for hundreds and hundreds of years, and from all different vantage points, from all different walks of life and perspective. And it just goes to show how big of a need this is. We want to know, how do I fulfill a life of pleasure? How do I enjoy what I'm doing? How do I find meaning in what I'm doing? And so I think from so many different people, from so many different angles, trying to reframe the conversation. And so what I try to do in the book is take all these voices together and say, hey, how do we navigate this conversation? How do we go to God's Word and figure out a way to kind of trudge our way through this? And come out and go, oh, it makes sense to me now. I know what to do now, you know, way better than I did before.
You cover such a wide variety of things that seem to be brought into this subject. Explain a little bit about the misuse of the Ten Commandments, of the picture of God some people get with their understanding of hell. In fact, all of these things you're suggesting gives us a negative picture of God rather than a God who wants to please us and we want to please him.
Right. Early on in the process of putting the book together, there was some initial discussion on why are two chapters in this book about the nature of God? And at first it almost didn't make sense to some of the early conversations of, well, shouldn't we just get right into pleasure, get right into
right.
the specifics? And yet for me, I really believe it is so linked to our view of God. Because for so many people, if I say the statement, God designed pleasure, for so many people in our country and just in our world today, they would go, yeah, I don't think so. And they'd have a really hard time with that. And so it goes back to what kind of a view of God do we have? When we picture God, what are we imagining? You know, is God the dad who comes home in the midst of when you're throwing a party and kicks all your friends out and shuts the light off? Or is God the dad who says, you know what, hey, why don't you use our house to host the party and
yeah.
invite your friends over? And those are dramatically different views of God or different views of a father that we have. And it starts to shape all these other specifics. And so for me, I think it's the starting point. And again, you ask people today, hey, what's God like? Oh, he has a bunch of rules. You know, those Ten Commandments. And he has all these expectations and he's angry.
Mm-hmm.
And he's constantly. And really, I think we've got to wrestle with this. And, you know, the Ten Commandments are 10 of 613 laws
right.
in the Old Testament. And you know, what gets a little uncomfortable about this is, you know, a lot of people, Christians, are like, yeah, we're supposed to live under the Ten Commandments. But most Christians, even who would say that, really only live under 9, because very few Christians live under Sabbath
right.
the way the Bible prescribes it. And so we're comfortable kind of going, all right, we'll take 9 out of the 10 and 10 out of the 613. And it's kind of this give and take. But really, it misses the point of what Jesus said when he said, hey, love God and love others. Like, uh-huh. this is what it all means. I have fulfilled all the rest of that. This is what I'm asking you to do. And I think it radically opens the door for us to experience just how great Jesus is.
But I wonder, what is there in people's perspective of God or of what it means to be a Christian that has brought in this negative attitude? I can remember in graduate school at a Christian university, you know, having these strange and weird conversations about if Adam and Eve were created on Friday, did they not have any sexual relationships till after sundown on Saturday because they didn't want to break the Sabbath or something like that?
Yeah, you get a little confusing at times,
right,
when we try to make sense out of it. And really, I talk about Adam and Eve in the book. Mm-hmm. It goes back to that discussion because what I find most intriguing, and again, whether or not people, you know, some people get hung up on is Adam and Eve, you know, are they literally people? Is it symbolic?
Right.
Is it poetry? It doesn't even matter where you land on that.
Yeah.
The point that I find most fascinating is the first challenge that the Bible portrays humanity facing. It is about pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
It's this ultimate choice of God said, hey, here's all of this garden I want you to experience. It is good. And he says, just don't eat that one tree. Just don't eat from that one tree. And what does Satan say? Hey, do it on your terms and you'll get more pleasure. You know, God doesn't know what he's talking about. You need to do it. And so my argument in the book is that by pursuing pleasure on our terms, we actually experience less of it. And I think it goes all the way back to the garden. Whenever we try to play God, whenever we try to figure out right and wrong, and we try to make up our own criteria, it always decreases the pleasure. And it's fascinating. What was the tree in the garden? It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And to give you a look at that, it sounds like it would be a good tree to eat from. You know, why is the knowledge of good and evil a bad thing?
Yeah.
And yet what I think it did is it created this sub-morality apart from God where they get to define the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And God saying, hey, I didn't create you for that. I created you to trust me. I think it's the same struggle we have all these years later.
Who was it said, love God and do as you please, because the more you love God, what pleases you and what pleases God becomes parallel. But when I say that at times to Christian people, they just stop and say, what do you mean? Do as you please. And there is this deep concern and this funny picture of God and pleasure.
Yeah, and I've had, you know, I've had conversations about grace with people, and I've heard it said, I forget who said this, but, you know, if you don't preach grace in such a way that people go and abuse it as a misunderstanding,
mm-hmm.
you haven't preached the fullness of grace.
Right.
Like, that's how it should always be misunderstood, is, oh, man, it means I can do anything because it's that good.
Yeah.
And we tend to go, oh, yeah, grace is good, but let
exactly.
me give you all the rules around it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's because I think we're afraid of what would people do with it? You know, what
right.
would they do with pleasure? Instead of going, let's just show people Jesus. The clearest, most beautiful, biblical picture of Jesus we can show them. And then let's let him shape their behaviors and their decisions. And I believe that the reason why you'd want to follow God is not because a bunch of people told you, well, God said so, and you should do it. But because you have found Jesus and you are enamored with him and you simply want to follow whatever he says. That, to me, is a much stronger Christianity.
If you just tuned in, I'm talking with Pastor Jeremy Jernigan. He's written a book called Redeeming Pleasure, How the Pursuit of Pleasure Mirrors Our Hunger for God. But you also suggest in your book that there are limits in pleasure.
Yeah. And again, you know, the limits of the garden was, hey, don't eat this tree. And there's a reason why. It's free will. And so God says, hey, I'm going to give you the ability to not choose me. I'm going to give you the ability to choose other things. And so it's the same thing today. I can choose to go, you know, have sex with whoever I want. I can choose to go do all these other things. And God will allow it. And yet he's going to be heartbroken over it because he knows it's not going to lead to more pleasure or more fulfillment in my life. And so really then the question is, do we trust Jesus enough to trust him with the limits? And the reason why is he designed it, you know, and I give, you know, a lot of different applications of this, but a real simple one is just think about making a meal and you want to have some friends over for dinner. You're going to go all out and, you know, and bake this full meal. Well, if you do that, there's all sorts of limits you have to work within. You know, you have to mix certain ingredients and not others. You have to bake it, certain temperatures for certain amounts of time. I mean, there's all these parameters around what we do. And if you were to go into that and say, you know what, forget that. I want to do it my way. I'm going to cook it however long I want. You're inviting disaster into that meal because there's parameters to get the best, out of it. And it's the same way with every pleasure we look at. Like, God is the designer. God created it and said, hey, it is good. Experience it this way. What Satan tries to do, because he cannot create pleasure, Satan says, the same argument as the garden, you don't need to trust God. You can do it on your own terms, and you can get more than what God is offering you. And it's the same lie that he tries to convince us with today.
But you bring it right down to a daily thing. You say your day job has as much potential for pleasure as your dream job. A lot of people might have problems with that.
Yeah. So there's a chapter on work, because work's one of those funny areas where we tend not to think of pleasure when it comes to that conversation. And it's because for a lot of people, they would say, I'm not in my dream job. And so I'm just paying the bills, or I'm just doing this or that. And I think it misses the point of when we redefine the conversation, we begin to see we can experience the life God designed us for in every area of what we're doing, even in work. And what's fascinating, if you go back to the story of Genesis, that work existed in the garden before the fall, that God had given him all these things, and it was a part of this ideal, scenario that God put him in. And after the fall, work got harder, and Adam was no longer working within the garden, but work existed before then. And so I also think, work's going to be a part of heaven, which for some people might not be the best idea, but I think it just changes our view of work. Going, you can experience pleasure in work. I have a chapter on parenting. A lot of people don't think of parenting as a pleasurable area as well. But really going, hey, when you begin to look at these key areas of our life, when we see who Jesus is, what he's inviting us into, we begin to experience a different type of pleasure in all these areas.
You at one point suggest there's a deception sometimes of pleasure that comes about. Unpack that a little bit for me.
Yeah, and it's that lie that, hey, do it on your terms and you'll get more of it.
Wow.
And I think the reality is when you pursue pleasure on your terms, whatever pleasure we're talking about, when you pursue it on your terms, you experience less of it. And the reverse is also true. When we trust God and we pursue pleasure on his terms, I believe we experience more of it. And you can take any pleasure, and again, in the book I try to argue logically as well as biblically, so that if someone isn't sure if they believe the Bible yet or they're wrestling with that, I also give a logical argument. And I talk about people who they have pursued the pleasure of the world, and people who sleep around every night and they go, oh, this is the life. And yet you really ask them and go, hey, the next morning, how do you feel? Is it everything you hoped it was going to be? Do you still feel that fulfillment, or is there something else there? Is there an emptiness there? Is there a guilt or a regret there? And you begin to unpack some of the baggage that goes along with this, and you realize it's a great deception, because the world is offering you one thing, and it does not deliver on its promise.
Towards the end of the book, you have a section called The Most Unpopular Word Ever. Tell us about that.
That word is surrender, and I've just realized in our culture that's about as anti-American as you can get. We don't like that concept. And I just tell a little bit of my own journey of coming to trust Jesus and trust in his goodness. And really with the nonviolence thing, it's what it means to be an American. We're pro-military, we're pro all of this, and really it started looking at Jesus and going, do I just trust him? I mean, do I legitimately trust him with my life, with my family? And if so, I don't need to try to make all these other things happen. I can just have a really a lifestyle of surrender to him, to go, you know what? I don't need to resort to some of the means of the world.
Uh-huh.
So again, I tell a little bit of my story about I grew up in Arizona. We're a little bit like the Wild Wild West still, and just a journey of moving toward nonviolence. Not because it's a position. I don't want to be a labeled as, oh, he's a pacifist. But really, I just think it's the most consistent application with what Jesus said. I had a friend tell me years ago, and this is when I owned guns and I was willing to defend myself and all this, and I mm-hmm. thought that was the way to live it. And he said, hey, what do you think Jesus meant when he said love his enemies, love your enemies? What do you think he meant when he said pray for those who persecute you? And it was one of those with some other enemies, not these kind of enemies. And so really, all this to me You know, some people are like, that seems like it's out of left field. To me, it's all related to what Jesus are we following here? What's the view of him? And then, you know, how much are we going to allow who he is to begin to transform the way that we view everything? And so we pursue pleasure in the people around us by sacrificing, by you know, treating them and their needs before us. You know, Luke 9:23, by learning how to die daily to ourselves and what we want, and you know, and put his kingdom first. And at first glance, you might think, wow, that does not sound fun. That does not sound like you're gaining something. And yet that's, I think, that's the intriguing part of this discussion as God's going, look, just trust me. You allow me to do it my way. Watch what I do in your life. And that has been my story. And that's the story I want to tell to as many people as possible.
There always seems to be this danger of creating God or creating Jesus in our own image, from our own perspective.
Yeah, and who doesn't want Jesus to agree with them, right? And you know, I would say, hey, yeah, he always supports, you know, he votes for the same people I vote for.
Right.
And, you know, he's angry at the same people I'm angry at. And I just think, you know, if we can get rid of some of the cultural baggage of Jesus and mm-hmm. just see him as accurately as we possibly can with all of our, you know, our limitations, I think it begins just to change our heart. And there's been so many areas of my life I've went, you know what? This makes the most sense to me, but this isn't consistent with who I see in Jesus. And then the question is, do I trust him? Do I trust him enough to say, hey, I'm going to do it your way, and I'm going to see what happens? And every time I have, I have seen him transform me and produce a deeper, more rich pleasure than I could have ever imagined.
Jeremy, whenever my blood pressure gets low, I turn on the television to some of the religious channels, and I listen to all these people who define very dogmatically what Jesus is like and what he would do in these circumstances without really even giving scriptural basis, let alone you know, something that seems reasonable within the context of what Jesus said. But please tell our listeners about the fight in the parking lot that didn't happen.
Yeah, you have really read the book. So there's this time where I was walking to the office one day, and I worked at a church, so we were there, and this guy, you know, I'm one of our employees who was talking to him, and he looks over my shoulder at the parking lot behind me, and he says, hey, there's two guys fighting. And I'm like, well, you know, what? What's going on? And so I turn around, and sure enough, there's two adults at the far end of the parking lot that were, you know, pushing one another. So this other guy sprints over, runs over to him, and so I figure, hey, I guess I should go run over to him as well. And
yeah.
we both end up running over there, and you know, as I'm running, I'm processing through, like, what on earth am I doing? You know, what am I about to do when I get here? And so it's just a long story, but basically we end up breaking up this fight and trying to help these two guys, and it was like a 50-year-old and a 60-year-old who were mad at each other for road rage, and decided to duke it out in a church parking lot of all areas. But as they left, you know, we were kind of like, wow, you know, I thought there was going to be someone that would, you know, because we had seen a police car drive by, but no one ever stopped, and it's kind of this weird situation. Mm-hmm. Well, as we're walking back to the offices, all of a sudden this patrol car comes screaming through the parking lot, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, now they're here. We can tell them the story. And the guy that I was with, he grew up in Los Angeles, and he goes, oh, no, man, they're going to think that we're the ones fighting. And I'm like, well, what do you mean, you know? And so the cop car pulls up, and sure enough, you know, slams on the brakes, opens the door, and yells at us, you know, put your hands on the hood of the car. And so, you know, in the blink of an eye, my friend is sprawled out in the hood. And so then I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I should do this too. And I had never done that before. It was kind of a weird feeling. And this whole story illustrated to me of this is just life. Is life comes at us so fast. And you know, we have conversations like this when we're thinking about going, how do I pursue pleasure here and there? And yet, what it really boils down to is what happens tonight when all of a sudden you're put in that situation that you weren't prepared for, and someone invites you to do something, or you get an invitation to this or that, and you begin to realize how quickly these decisions have to be made and the ramifications of it. And so I just use that story to illustrate. Man, it's a fun story to tell, but it's kind of a crazy story, and I had no idea what the outcome of that is, but it reminds me, you have to decide in advance. What's your stance on Jesus? What do you trust him or not? Because, and again, however you want to apply this, to the high school student who's going to get offered a drink mm-hmm. at a party, you know, that's
yes.
where they have to decide, hey, do I trust God enough to wait and to do it his way, or am I going to do this? To the a couple who's dating and is deciding, do we wait to have sex before we're married? Or, I mean, you have to decide these in advance because life comes at you quickly. And most of us, we don't ever think about it in advance. We don't read books like this in advance. We just go with the flow, and then we look back the next morning and go, oh, what did I do? And so my you know, plea is to encourage people, hey, think about it in advance. Make the decision beforehand. And then when you find yourself in a situation, you'll already have made that decision.
The book is Redeeming Pleasure. The author is Pastor Jeremy Jernigan. Jeremy, where can our listeners get a copy of your book?
So it's available anywhere books are sold, Amazon, iBooks, Barnes & Noble. I also created a website, redeemingpleasure.com. They can find out more about the book there as well. And there's also a three-week YouVersion Bible reading plan for the book, and that's absolutely free. They can get that through the YouVersion app if they're interested.
Pastor Jeremy, thanks for being with us today on LifeQuest.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.